Sound of time passing. Air. Pauses at night. Sound of separation. Radio of unsettled frequencies.
Can you remember the first time you saw closed captions?
Music.
Turning on the subtitle setting so you can read the sound of a show.
Sound of secret speech.
I've always watched TV passively. I can't hear it unless it's turned up loud.
Music swells.
But since the lockdown started, I've binged a lot of TV.
Sound of doing nothing.
Reading the sound world of the shows I am watching has made me wonder about the act of translation.
Sound of becoming visible.
Of how a sound is turned into a word.
Music ends.
The earliest memory that I have of closed captioning was via Sesame Street.
Meg Day is a friend of mine, a poet and assistant professor of English and creative writing at Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania.
I remember very clearly closed captioning provided by, and then it would cut to some kind of product or service, but then the commercial would not be captioned. So I have this very distinct memory of the programming being, I don't know, valuable enough, important enough to be captioned, but then also an understanding that captioning was not necessarily equitable or compulsory because someone had to sponsor it. So there was something about television that seemed both real and not real to me. It was like when the captions were happening, television was real and it was worth paying attention to. And then when there were no caption, it turned into a different kind of, I don't know, dramatic production where I'm like, oh, I can invent what's happening.
Gunshots. Car speeds off. Heartbeat. Gasping. Sirens. Heartbeat stops.
As a deaf person in the hearing world, I know that there is no universal experience of sound. So how can we capture what it is? How do we turn sound into words? What is sound?
I think it's a kind of mythology. It's an inherited form, maybe. Just another way to understand the world. Deaf poet Ilya Kaminsky and I have talked a lot about sound being an invention of the hearing. Silence, too. I think often about how our common understanding of sound is that it is natural and given and compulsory, that it's just a thing that, occurs to us. But if it is that sound is, you know, waves knocking around in the cave of one's head and then processed in some kind of approximated but not necessarily universal way, then isn't sound just a metaphor? It's one way for experiences to touch.
Thunder. Sirens. Sobs. Wailing. Knocking. 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 Door opens.
What is sound, Raymond?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question for me because it makes me think of how in literature, so much literature for so long in the Western world, there's a kind of tone which assumes this kind of universality. And there's just so much to undo. and that voice. And I think that undoing sound or the kind of mainstream idea of sound can be a, I believe, and I don't yet have the language for it, but I believe it is a useful endeavor.
Sound of sky splitting. Sound of emergency. Sound of heart accelerating. Sound of pain spreading. Sound of red hands. Sound of shadows behind a door. Sound of something inward. Sound of something invented.
So in the hearing world, relying on subtitles and closed captions, something that I've had to do growing up, but for most of the time had been absent. Like if I was watching films, there weren't any like subtitles or closed captions on those VHS tapes. And I was thinking back through that recently, actually, and I went back to re-watch some of the films that I'd only watched as a kid and that I'd never watched before with subtitles or closed captions. And I'm kind of blown away by how many plots of the films I'd actually gotten wrong. Like I'd kind of made up my own story for what I didn't understand.
Yes. Yeah, you just filled in the blanks.
Exactly, right? And so, if I'm honest, in some cases I was quite disappointed with it, because it's like, oh, I thought this whole other thing happens, whole other universe, and it's just actually pretty straightforward.
What a disappointment.
The sound of sun entering the bedroom. The sound of eyelids opening.
Christine Sun Kim is an American sound artist based in Berlin. Her work inspired some of my thinking around sound and text. I'd seen Kim rewrite caption text from films in order to revise the listening experience from hearing-centric to deaf-centric. In one interview, Kim asked her audience, does sound itself have to be a sound? Could it be a feeling, emotion, or an object? Could time itself become a sound?
So I actually just did a video called Closer Captions, and that video for me is a video full of my interpretations, my decisions, and me playing around with showing what options could be out there.
Kim uses American Sign Language, so is speaking via video call. The voice you're hearing is the voice of her interpreter, Beth.
Because I feel like captions have boundaries and they can be limited. And sometimes there is the question of who made these decisions to put these sound captions out, right? And there is a discussion in response of like, but who in general should be making the kind of decisions about how subjective these captions should be? But that's not really my question, right? And that's not really what I'm doing. I don't always want poetic captions. It does depend on the context. Sometimes I just want to watch a movie where the word music in parentheses is good enough. And sometimes I want more information.
Mournful music that sounds like crying alone in an empty bar. In 1920s Paris, you're wearing a tiny but fashionable hat that you tip to the bartender as you order your fourth martini.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with the show The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. For me, that's one of the shows that just has the best sound captions out there. The sound captions include feelings, emotions, like it'll say anticipating, waiting, all those things are in the sound captions. And I get the feeling that those sound captions probably came from the script writer. And I'm not sure, right? I'm always wondering, regardless of what I'm watching, who is the person responsible behind making these sound captions?
I remember very clearly when Princess Diana died. I remember where I was, what I was wearing, where I was sitting, the time of day, and the announcement came over the closed captioning on a television program, actually like covered the closed captioning, the news, the report that Princess Diana had died. And it felt a lot like the voice of God, that there was someone or something out there that can interrupt television to tell you when important people die. And it gave me this sort of unexpected comfort that I think kind of persists. Like, I don't have great attraction to television in general. I don't watch a lot of television. And, you know, movie theaters are a whole different deal, as you know. But I do find that when the captions are compulsory, when, you know, you go to a streaming service and it has remembered your settings and the captions just appear and they're in real time, they're not delayed, you know, everything's working smoothly, there is this kind of comfort where I'm like, ah, I recognize it in my body. And I think that's tied back to this sense that there is someone or something out there that can send you a message through captioning at any time.
Muffled. Sound of one story. Heart accelerating. Sound of skin covering bodies.
We do try and remove as much subjectivity as possible.
Callum Davidson is a captioner, or what some may call the voice of God. He also trains others how to caption films and TV.
When there are sounds that we're trying to describe, we try and be really careful about what we're doing about that, because we don't want to give away the game early if it's horror films.
Low thud and creaking.
You know, if you describe the sound of a...
Creaking. Rhythmic thudding.
The sound of a ghost approaching down the hall.
Rhythmic thudding grows louder. Thudding and creaking grows faster.
You don't use the word ghost in the description.
Raindrops drumming.
Because that's, you know, you're depriving somebody the opportunity to actually discover that at the time the program maker wants them to discover it.
Thunder crashes. Distant music box tinkling.
We get a lot of feedback about quiz shows giving away the answer in the question, which is just rule number one, man. That's like, where as soon as people come in, don't put the question up on the same caption as the answer. Like, that's just rubbish. Jokes as well, comedy shows, don't give the punchline away with the build-up. Like, it's, you have to let people come to it in their own time.
Are captions a transcription or a translation of speech and sound? What assumptions do captioners have to make about their audience?
Taking dialogue and putting it into text. Like, there's a translation there because people don't speak in regularly punctuated sentences and they don't finish their sentences. They and they are, and there's abandoned thoughts half the way through that if we transcribed it word for word, when you read a transcription like that, it's really difficult to understand. Now, that might be the point in some cases. We have quite a lot of debate about how closely to transcribe politicians, for example, some politicians, where them prevaricating or talking around a subject and umming and aahing is quite revealing. But if you take that to the other extreme, where it's someone who's being interviewed who is upset, I don't know, someone that's gone through something horrendous and they're stammering because it's difficult to talk about, you might indicate the stammer a little bit in the captions. But you're not going to write every vowel sound they make. You're not going to write every noise they utter, because it starts to look quite insensitive, you know. We walk quite a tightrope, but we do tend towards objectivity. We try and make it as fact-based and as brief as possible. If you can read it, instantly take it in, and then move on with the film. That's what we think a successful caption is. It's been interesting thinking about this because it started to make me question quite a lot of what we take for granted in that.
Sound of wider seeing.
Something I would have loved is like a degreeometer, if you will, of like how much information in my sound captions do I want, and something that I could toggle on a spectrum, right? Today I'd like only a little bit of sound captioning detail, and tomorrow I want a ton. Or if I could ask for who I'd want to be the sound captioner. Today I want person A and tomorrow I want person B to do the sound captioning.
I have favorite interpreters for particular events or scenarios, different styles of interpreting, different topics or environments in which they really excel. And I'd love for that to be the case with captioners. Like, I want to know who they are and what their style is, and I want to, you know, go see a film based on who the captioner is. I think that that might make a huge, like, can we get baseball cards? You know, like, I think that it probably requires a great amount of skill. And I just, yeah, I would love to know more about that and then have, I don't know, have some kind of choice about it.
For me, from a storytelling point of view, sound is a sort of emotional space and a non-literal space. I think it's about perspective, giving people the opportunity to experience somebody's perspective.
Lindsay Dryden is a filmmaker and founding member of Forward Doc, an organisation that's seeking greater inclusion of deafness and disability within the entertainment industry.
Part of what we really encourage people to do is to think about captioning and audio description as an embedded part of storytelling. You're not just adding on something ugly and irritating at the end. It's the very opposite of that. This is like a whole strand of how you tell your story, how you give your audience the opportunity to engage with your characters, your storytelling perspective. You know, there's that short film called Dawn of the Deaf, directed by Rob Savage, and there's a couple who are BSL users in that film. And there's a point in the film where they're having an argument.
I just feel everyone looking at us. I can't talk to you right now.
And we only get to see the parts of the captions on screen that the audience would be able to see if they could read their lips. You're only given access to part of the perspective, and I think that kind of approach to language and to communication has to be embedded in our storytelling more generally. So I think we are at a time of exciting opportunity.
Sound of distant radio.
So this is my first time making a radio program, and I'm conscious of making something in a medium that excludes us, deaf people, hard of hearing people. How do I create work that doesn't privilege a hearing audience? I've written the transcript for this show, something that I hope offers an even richer version of this work than the audio version. And I wanted to ask deaf artists what their relationship is to radio as a medium. I wanted to know if I was going to achieve a richer, non-hearing-centric show, what can I learn from them?
I have a little bit of a relationship with the radio. For me, growing up, my parents didn't really like use the radio that much, but reading history books, I saw that FDR would give his fireside chats and families would sit around and listen to the radio. And the radio seemed to indicate times that families would get together and spend time together. And I understood that through history books, right? And I knew also growing up that when my friends and I were driving around, we'd play around with the radio in the car, right? And we'd try to find a station that had some bass. And we'd just drive around with some bass, right? Like if we could feel that beat, we would just kind of go through all the channels. We have no idea, right? But if we could feel that sensation in the car, that was a connection. So for me, radio almost means like a search, and a search that happens like in an enclosed space. Radio also works better in an enclosed space because then you can feel those vibrations as a vibrational device.
Place your hand on the radio.
I've been thinking about something Meg Day said in an interview. I'm going to read the quote. I was obsessed with the radio because the radio is a thing that you can put your hand to and feel. It's like a drum. You can feel the rhythm, the beat. I think just fascination with sound, and then this intense obsession with trying to feel my poems with sonic play. I was often told that my poems needed sounds that leap across the field instead of sounding like some jackhammer in a city.
Music ends.
I resonate with this because it's something that I too am interested in. As a kid, I would listen to the radio, but it would be this thing that would get me into trouble because I had to turn it up too loud for everyone else, my parents and my neighbours. So I'd have to record the shows that I wanted and wait until everyone was out the house and play them through the tape with the sound up. I asked Meg this question, poet to poet, how might we make radio lean into us, into our sound, in a similar way as to how, as poets, we make poetry lean into us?
I wish that the radio would lean into its own physical quality. I think that there's a lot of like really technically cool things about radios, but I would love if they were built for deaf folks. You know, like my partner and I are expecting a child, and it's COVID, which is wild for deaf folks, as you know, with masks. And, you know, we went to the appointment and they're finding the heartbeat and everyone's in, you know, being weird in the room. Everyone's so sad that they're going to find this heartbeat and I won't be able to hear it. And so they find the heartbeat, and, you know, everybody's faces light up in the room. They're like, are you seeing it? And I'm like, well, can I hold the monitor? You know, and I know that you know this, that when you use your hands for things, especially language, your sense of touch is something otherworldly, is absolutely wild, right? And so I'm holding my kid's heartbeat in my hand. Like, I'm holding my kid's heart right there in my hand. And it's like my whole arm is vibrating. They've got it turned up so high, and it's like it's the radio all over again, except that it is the future. And so I think of that, and I think of the way that sound is a kind of synesthesia for so many people, regardless of whether or not we call them deaf kin. And I wish that the radio, as if it's, you know, the radio people out there, would understand that and then make them with us in mind, make them with like high reverb materials, make them with a I'm alone in my house version of the volume. I think that there's so much untapped potential for experiencing sound as what it is, which is certain mythology, absolutely, but also physical vibration.
This is actually one of your own questions that you ask your audiences in your work. And I'm curious to what you have to say to this today, where you're at now. But what is sound?
Sound of interpretation.
So I think I answer this question differently every time. But a long time ago, I answered that question with a response that I think is still applicable now. But to me, sound feels a little bit expensive. Every time I need to exercise my place, my space, my position in the world, I need an interpreter. That's how the world works, right? Like, I could do without an interpreter typing back and forth, but there's nothing as fluid or as immediate as being able to bring in an interpreter for that. And for me, what's really interesting about that process is the interpreter's voice and my voice become one. Right. Mm-hmm. And it feels like dating. Like, if I didn't like Beth, we're screwed for this interview. Thank God, though, we like each other. But
so we're deaf folks on the radio and no one can see us right now. They can't see Emily. And so we just sound like regular fools on the radio. Right. And so I'm thinking a lot about the visibility of access. I think about it in terms of captioning also, the evidence of access, the presence of an interpreter or captioning is one of our kinds of visibility as deaf folks. And it brings me really closely and swiftly to a question of lip reading and speech reading with masks, not having access to this form of interaction right now.
Just before lockdown, my last reading was at the Hidden Hearing Convention for Audiologists. I was invited into their labs and shown more advanced hearing aids than my NHS ones. I was given new digital hearing aids which sync with all my devices, my computer, phone, TV and doorbell, Everything is coordinated sonically in a way that is new. For the first time, I can hear through the walls. In lockdown, there have been reports that some deaf and hard of hearing people have suffered double the intensity of isolation because of deafness. Despite the power of my new hearing aids, I hate that they are hidden, invisible to most eyes. It has meant that going out to shops and everyone being masked, I can't lip read and have to keep pointing out my hearing aids so my deafness is understood. There are many days that I don't want to think about deafness, let alone explain it to hearing people, but the state of the world now doesn't give me that luxury.
In the US, we've got like a term called HPA. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it stands for hearing people anxiety. It's kind of like a new term that's kind of come out. I think younger deaf people are using this term, and it just means like whenever you go to any kind of situation where you realize that everyone's going to be hearing and no one knows sign language, it doesn't matter if that's a party, the bar, a lecture, you get that anxiety where you know that no one's going to be able to understand you in that sense. And you kind of have to build up your resilience to get through the event. I don't personally lip read. I don't speak. And so for me, finding that accommodation between myself and a hearing person to communicate is a little bit more work. And so the anxiety that I feel around that, we call HPA. And I think that that's also maybe a syndrome that we experienced growing up as well, and in a way that we felt not on equal grounds with the people that we interacted with. A lot of us by default become activists because we've spent a lot of our lives fighting to get and ensure our basic rights. Whereas hearing people don't even question that, right? The system is ready and made for them. They don't encounter that many barriers, if any at all.
Sound of ending with a question.
What is sound to you? What kind of relationship do you have with it? What kind of relationship do you want with it?
Sound of revealing a lie.
I discovered a while ago that the idea that we have five senses is not quite true.
Sound of forest renewing.
Poets, artists, free thinkers, and those living with synesthesia know we can combine senses and develop a language for them, which can become something new. A sound can become a sight.
Sound of garden withering.
A feeling.
Sound of astonishment.
Something that we invent.
Sound of newer names.
Sound of newer names.